Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. This is episode 175. We're talking about energy intake, aka how many calories do you need and what do calories do? But
fair
anyway,
enough. That's a good time.
Yeah, that works. What's going on, man? How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I think we might have skipped a week there, but in between, since the last episode, been continuing to coordinate this move and training and working in the hospital this week and all kinds of stuff going on at the moment on my end, but we're getting by.
Yeah, I think it's okay if we take a 2-week break. That's what we took 2 weeks off. We had, you know, look, we work for 50 weeks. We got a 2-week vacation built into our podcast package, you know. And we're back. We're back in action. Yeah, we usually try to put out something every week. Had to take a few weeks off due to some other job-related stuff. And yeah, but we're back. We plan on keep pumping out these episodes. And speaking of which, we're trying to bring on a few highly curated, highly on-brand people within the industry to help sponsor the show. So basically, not bring them on as like hosts, but bring them on as sponsors. Thing is, I do all of the editing. All of the coordination, all, you know, this is like a one-man band. Austin hops on and brings his expertise. But in order to like keep this thing rolling, we're going to need to outsource some of the editing, some of the production stuff. And so we thought, hey, if we get a few like sponsors for the show, we can cover that. Otherwise, you know, just hemorrhaging time and money. And so what we need from you guys, because we're getting, you know, 30, 40 plus thousand downloads a week. We need some information. We're going to put out a survey. The link is in the description below. So if you listen to our podcast, you like our podcast, even if you don't like it, but you still listen to it, just click on the survey, fill it out. That way it helps us, you know, get some of these sponsors. We're not going to have a long ad read at the beginning of the show or the end of the show or in the middle of the show. We're not going to do that. It's going to be like two or three, organizations that we are already like invested in. We like them. All right. We know that they're putting out good stuff. So there's no reads for like electrolyte supplements or like CBD salve or whatever. But, you know, some brands that we're either already using or already, you know, kind of recommending. And yeah, sponsor our show and help offload some of these responsibilities so we can keep focusing on the content rather than, you know, recording, editing, all this other sort of stuff. Otherwise, it's going to be you, Austin. You're going to be sitting here with Adobe Audition editing stuff. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that it, people probably don't recognize how much work goes into actually producing a decent quality episode. Like, it's easy to get on and just babble about all kinds of stuff. But if you want to, you know, have it be at least somewhat refined, if it's not going to be fully scripted, which some of the best, you know, well-produced podcasts out there are like scripted start to finish, which is probably not something that's exactly feasible for us in many situations. But for something to be refined and deliver a message effectively and kind of hit the high points that we want to hit when we're delivering some of this information, it does take a fair amount of work. And so to have that fair amount of work that is not ever going to change, and then tack onto that a whole bunch of additional editing and production and, you know, all the other stuff that you do on the other side of that, is a fairly substantial demand on time and effort and energy and things like that. So getting some assistance with that, I agree, it would help us put more focus on, you know, where our expertise is best utilized.
Yeah, it's better if we get to focus on the content rather than the production quality, and let the experts in production quality do that. So yeah, anyway, that's a long lead into our ask, which is to click on the survey link in the description below, answer some questions, and that'll help us, you know, track down some sponsors that won't annoy the crap out of you or us at the beginning of the show. So anyway, other things, other announcements, we got new shirts available on the website right now. They are a meat version 2.0 shirts. Now, speaking of meats, I got a meat coming up. We'll talk about that here in a second. I feel like the news just broke to the people who are invested in, you know, what's going on training wise. But yeah, they have some new shirts that are specific for a powerlifting competition. They've got the logo just under the collar on the front and rear. So it says Barbell Medicine on the front, Stronger Together on the back. On the sleeve, it's the BBM logo. Looks really fresh under a singlet. But I've worn them sans singlet, and people are like, that shirt slaps. So yeah, we got those. Nice. Yeah, we've got some of the new Stronger Together shirts. That's all available on the website. Still have our Lift for Life charity shirt available. A few of those left. So check out the merch on the website. And then last but not least, still got our app. Our app is freely available for download on the Apple App Store. Our latest update. Well, we got two latest updates. One update, you get the free first week of any of our templates on there. If you're deciding between, should I run Power Building 1, Strength 1, Endurance 1, or something more advanced than that, you can check out the first week for free on the app. We're not even going to ask you for a credit card. Like, you can just do the first week. And then at the end, if you want to, you know, continue on, well, then you can decide to enter in some of your information and buy the template. Also, we're updating all of our rehab templates. The new hip rehab template's up. The shoulder rehab template is up. The knee and low back one should be up very shortly. I'm not sure if they're uploaded into the app. We did considerable amounts of updates on those apps, but they're available on the website. And then the last app update, this one's really cool. It's like a template picker algorithm. So I went into the matrix that is my template brain. I ferreted out an algorithm on like how I would direct somebody to pick a template based on some responses to questions. How often do you want to train? How much training history do you have? What are your goals? Things of that nature. And then, so yeah, it gives us the top three recommendations, just like you were having coffee with me. And that's what I would do. So all that's available on the app. Really excited for the latest updates. Should be there. I get confused because what happens with the app is you like make an update and you submit it to Apple, and then they're like, it's under review. And then they're like, it's good to go. And I'm like, wait, does that mean the app is live? Like, it's the update is live, or like, is there another update on top of the update? It's like exhibit, you know, yo dog, I heard you like updates, so we're going to put updates on your updates. I don't know. So we'll see. Other than that, I think that's all I got for announcements. You want to talk about training for a little bit, you know, because
people are interested, I guess.
I don't know if they are. I don't know if they are, that they are, but, you know, invariably, whenever we get on podcasts, we want to talk about training. This is the Barbell Medicine Podcast. We're going to talk about barbells for a minute. Yeah, I have a meet coming up on Saturday. So this is, yeah, so a couple of days. This should go up on Wednesday. So yeah, you know, 4 days later, 3 days later, I'll be competing. I'd signed up for this meet after I came back from the adductor tear. Like, I was like pretty much back to 100%, or at least close enough to not really notice it. And I was like, oh, I'll sign up for a meet. And then like a month later, I dislocated my shoulder and I was like, damn it. But in any case, I kept training, and I made like this kind of deal with myself. If I was getting closer to a 400-pound bench, that I would just do the meet regardless. And for whatever reason, training is like really good. I'm the lightest I've been in the last 8 months plus. I'm doing the most conditioning I've probably ever done, you know, since I've been lifting weights, and all my numbers, and I'm squatting with the bar an inch and a half higher. So it's weird that I'm squatting without hamstrings now. It's effectively a high bar squat. And self lift off, no wrist wrap. I mean, a lot of stuff in my training has just been tweaked a little bit. And I think it's because I go into training sessions and I'm just like, I'm going to take what's there for the day. I'm not too invested in this because I'm not putting any pressure on myself. And I think a lot of that has to do with the injury.
Yeah.
The injuries, right? It's just like, yeah, I could put all this pressure and all these expectations, but since I'm coming back from those, they've been really kind of wiped out. And so, yeah, I'm going to go to the meet. I probably won't set a PR meet total all time just because I'm not using knee wraps, but we're going to get close.
Yeah. I mean, we had this conversation and, you know, it's funny that the way you describe that approach to training, it's like kind of like what we recommend for people in general and what we try to do. But of course, that's always easier said than done, especially when you, you know, care about what you're doing, you care about your performance and you want to see the numbers go up. It's easier said than done to just be like, yeah, I'm going to take what's there today and not nudge things ever higher, even when it may not be appropriate. But we talked a little bit about your training approach. And, you know, I remember, I don't know, this might've been 6 weeks ago or something when we were starting to enter like the final stage towards this meet. And I was like, well, what if you ended up going to this meet and then just, you know, if necessary, just work up and do like a powerlifting meet at RPE 8 or something, if you had to, like keep it pretty sub maximal, just depending on how things felt, your shoulder or anything else that had maybe not to 100% yet. But it seems like you said things are going really well. I still don't know whether, you know, you're planning, it's probably going to be a game day kind of call of how high up you want to turn things. But I think that there's something to be said for when you've had a bit of time away from a powerlifting meet and getting back into it, just putting up like a solid performance, be it 9 for 9 or, you know, a total within some percentage that you deem, you know, acceptable of your best or something like that. It can help psychologically. It can build momentum towards subsequent performances and keep you excited about training, you know, on the other side of it too, instead of like building up so much hype and expectation for one meet. And then you get, you know, severe post-meet blues, or you have an incident like your last meet and things like that.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that was the thing. I just built up that last meet. And I think what begat, that's a word, like, right?
Maybe.
whatever. You guys know what I was trying to say. That training was going well before I had really signed up for that last meet. And so I like had these expectations, like I'm going to finally break my PR total. Like I'm going to do it. And then, yeah, training went well enough until the very end where I got sick and whatever, and then ultimately tore my adductor. Yeah, I think that's just the difference. I have all these historical performances, and I'm like, well, if I don't beat those, then why am I even signing up for the meet? It's just not, I don't want to go to a meet and just like show up. But now it's kind of like, man, I haven't really been able to put up a total in like almost 3 years.
Yeah.
Between the pandemic and then this last meet with the adductor. So I'm just like, one, I just want to go have fun.
Yeah.
I am really having fun training. And if I put up My expectations are that anything over 1700 is a win as a total. And I think that's easily within reach as far as a stretch goal. I think anything in the 1750 to 1770 range would be like, damn, you done did it. That was a good meet. Yeah. And my plan is to not push squats or bench only because like, what's the point? I don't need to like, I'm not going to win a national meet or like qualify for some next level. This is literally just me showing up to some random gym in Southern California.
Yeah.
And
picking up some metal.
Yeah. So no, I'm excited to compete. It's going to be fun. I think, 280, 190, 330 would be great. That would be my stretch goal, and I've hit all those in training within the last week. And,
what's the current conditioning looking like that you, mentioned?
Yeah. So, 3 to 4 days a week, I'm doing like steady state stuff. Usually it's either the 2 days, like 30 minutes RP6. I'm either on the rower, the bike, either stationary or outside for that. And then on weeks when I have, and one of the sessions is a longer session, like 90 minutes, same thing, RP6. And how I do that, I'm staying in 120s to 130 beats per minute heart rate. And so the way I track progress is just like, what's my pace? Mm-hmm. If I can maintain a faster pace, you know, with a heart rate being capped, that's just like, cool. Your submaximal aerobic capacity is going up. So that's 3 to 4 days a week of that. And then I'll do 2 days per week of intervals. One's going to be aerobic intervals. So like 1-to-1 or 1-to-2 work to rest ratio. So minute on, minute off, something like that. Minute on, 2 minutes off, or 2 minutes on, 1 minute, something like that. And usually I'll be between the ski erg and the rower for that. And then one day is going to be anaerobic intervals. And that's just going to be 1-to-4, 1-to-5 work to rest ratio. And I usually do that on the ski erg. And I've been really enjoying the ski erg because it allows me to like push my shoulder in a way that's different from the gym. And so I don't know that it's therapeutic, like, well, it makes my shoulder feel better, but it certainly allows me to kind of like, yeah, not only are you going to like lift a weight, but you're going to like keep doing it over and over and over again, a dynamic position. And I get a sick, sick pump from the ski erg on my arms. Oh my God. Like if I was, I, you know, you like having a pump, you walk around, you're like, hey, I'm all jacked right now. I, the bodybuilding thing, I think the gene missed me, like where I'm like, eh, no, whatever, I can take it or leave it. But if I was into that, I think I would do, instead of like pumping up in the pump up room, I would just get a ski erg back there and like.
That's interesting. I've never trained on a ski erg, done all the other conditioning kind of modalities, but not that one.
Yeah. I was talking to Derek. He's like one thing for people who are either can't bear weight or, you know, have other issues, like some mobility needs for, they can't cycle with high intensity or regularly, they got a lower extremity injury, whatever. Get them on a ski erg and have them go to town. Really lets them like just let loose pretty much. Yeah. And I was like, huh. This was after the adductor thing, but I'm like, I wonder how that's going to feel on the shoulder. And yeah, it's been nice. I'm just trying to get in better shape for motocross. I mean, that's the whole thing. Like I'm spending all this money, all this time, like practicing, trying to get back into racing. And it's not that I can't just go ride around. But that's not the point. I can't ride at a high level for an extended period of time without this conditioning base that I've, don't have right now.
Yeah.
And people are like, well, aren't you afraid of like, you're losing gains? I'm like, no,
doesn't seem to be happening.
No, but I didn't start here. I started with 3 days a week at 30 minutes at RP6. And I will tell you that the pace that I was maintaining on both the rower and my bike was much slower. So for example, I was at like 240 on a 2 minutes and 40 seconds on the bike for, I think it's at per 1,000 meters or whatever the thing says. And now I'm at 220, but the heart rate is the same. So it's like, wow, that you got way better. The wildest thing is in the gym though. I get done with like a heavy set and yeah, you're out of breath. Same as normal, you know? And then my heart rate's back under, you know, 90 within 60 seconds. Like I did my last warm up. I did a 265 kilo squat. This is good about like my opener or something like that. And I did it. My heart rate when I was sitting there last time I looked at it before I walked up to the bar, it was 81. And I was like, that's not resting, obviously, but you know, to be in the gym and just like chilling. I don't know.
Interesting stuff, man. That's cool.
I appreciate that you're okay with not being strong for another 3 or 4 days because the balance of power, you know, is in my favor right now.
It tends to swing pretty dramatically, doesn't it?
Yeah. Have we ever been strong at the same time?
I don't know. I've tried to think about this. Maybe on like certain lifts, but across the board, I don't think so.
Yeah. Like we never have done the same meet together, right? Yeah. And then we've never been so there's probably some like recall bias. They're like, well, you know, you weren't strong then when I was prepping for this meet and vice versa. But yeah, it is. If you're wondering like why we make that joke, it is interesting that only one of us is strong at it one time. it's like, are Austin and Jordan the same person? I've never seen them both in the same room. Like, so anyway, all right. Well, the next podcast will have a meet recap and let's, you know, I think it's going to be positive. I mean, either way, like I said, I'm going to have fun and I don't think there's likely to be any RP10 efforts except for maybe the third deadlift if I want to go full send for something.
Yeah. And at that point, you know, why not?
Yeah. You know, I've never gone 9 for 9.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I historically have made like really large jumps to my first and my second deadlift. And then at that point, it's like, you're kind of fried. What do you do now?
Yeah.
I just took a 40 kilo jump. Anyway. All right, so we're going to hop into this podcast topic for today. We're going to try to make this as practical as possible, also giving you guys a good hefty dose of knowledge for your brain hole. I got a couple DMs unrelated last, but they were the same question effectively. They're like, how do I figure out how many calories I need per day? And this is not a unique question. I get this oft all the time, but since these both happen in close proximity to each other, and I'm just like, we don't really have a good resource for this out there. I figure we do a podcast. So this is a question that a lot of you listening to are probably like, yeah, I would want to know that. And if you want to save yourself the trouble, I'll cut to the good part. There are ways to calculate this. None of them great. You probably don't need to actually know this in order to make changes in your behaviors that would benefit your health, your performance, etc. But if you want to know all the stuff in the middle, listen on. All right. So first off, what is a calorie? So we have to talk about energy first. The energy is the capacity to do work on or provide heat to an object. Calories are the unit of measurement used to measure energy, much in the same way seconds are used to measure time and kilograms are used to measure mass. So when someone asks, is a calorie? The answer is unequivocally, yes, it's just a unit of measurement. Technically speaking, a calorie with a lowercase c is the amount of energy required to raise the temperature of 1 gram of water by 1 degree Celsius. Our food contains thousands of times more energy than this. So rather than use the term kilocalories when measuring energy in food, the term has been abbreviated as calories with an uppercase C. So one calorie with the uppercase C is equivalent to 1 kilocalorie or 1,000 calories with a lowercase C. There's been a lot of confusion about this. So in the 1950s, when the SI system introduced the term joules to measure energy, basically, nutritional science and researchers stopped using calories. Calories have been around since the 19th century, the early 1800s, mid 1800s is when this kind of came into the lexicon. But as of in the 1950s, the SI system was introduced and everybody else picked up joules. But, public health kind of public health. And they were like, well, we can't really ask the public to understand a new term. So we're just going to stick with calories. But not the one with the lowercase c. We're going to do the one with the uppercase c, which is even crazier because when you look at like public statements or public health documents, even like the public health professionals can't keep these things straight. They'll say calories with an uppercase c in one sentence and calories with the lowercase c in the next sentence and use kilocalories throughout the it's like just use the same word the whole time. Just stick with one. But in any case, long and short of it is that when you see calories on your food label, if you're in the United States, uppercase C.
And in Europe, they actually do use the joules on their label or kilojoules.
Yeah, because they smart like that. And we're just nah. Yeah. Super interesting. If you want to get into the history of this, I've linked a couple resources in the description below. One is by James Hargrove. Does the history of food energy units suggest a solution to calorie confusion? Also, there's another text called The History of the Calorie in Nutrition. If you want to go back into like French chemists, Lavoisier, and then Carnot, et cetera, who's not French, but in any case, we're going way back. You can read that. If you just want to move on with your life and take what I said at face value, listen on. All right. So we've talked about what a calorie is and how this relates to the current discussion is to do with energy balance. So if you think back to your high school chemistry class, you learned about thermodynamics. The first law of thermodynamics is the law of energy conservation. So energy cannot be created or destroyed, only transformed. With respect to human nutrition, this law means that any change to the body's energy stores, the body stores energy as fat, carbohydrates, you may have heard this as glycogen, muscle glycogen, liver glycogen, etc. And also protein. Protein is in the muscle tissues and all your soft tissues that make up your organs, etc. So that's how your body stores energy. So the law of energy conservation means that any change to the body's energy stores, that's fat, carbohydrate, and protein, is equal to the energy consumed from food minus the energy expended to do whatever the body needs to do, whether that be maintain its function, be active, etc. So energy balance refers to the relationship between energy intake and energy expenditure. So if you are consuming more energy than you're expending, you're in a positive energy balance. If you're consuming less energy than you're expending, you're in a negative energy balance. That's the whole relationship. I'm sure, Austin, when you're counseling patients, that's how you start off the nutrition recommendation. You just talk about energy balance and the law of thermodynamics.
I write out the math, tell them to eat less, move more, and kick them out the door.
Yeah, it's simple. Because if they just knew,
yeah,
they would change their behaviors. Yeah. So again, all of this stuff is in the middle, like of stuff that you don't really need to know. But if you're trying to like have a higher level discussion about this, it's a fundamental knowledge you must possess to really discuss this. But not to make a healthy or performance enhancing behavioral change. This is just the nuts and bolts, the weeds, if you will. Okay. So let's start out. We're going to talk about energy intake and energy expenditure. Let's start out with energy intake. So energy intake refers to all calorie containing items consumed in a given period of time, usually a day by convention, but it could be a week, could be a month, etc. So this includes protein, carbohydrates, and fats primarily, and also alcohol. Could be a small amount of alcohol. If you drink a small amount of alcohol, could be a large amount if you drink a large amount of alcohol. Interestingly, net absorption, so energy from these foods, may vary. Fecal losses vary anywhere between 2 to 10%, and this is dynamic, 2 to 10% of energy intake. So that what that means is if you're eating 3,000 calories a day, you could be losing upwards of 200, or close to 300 calories from your food due to fecal losses. So for example, there were overfeeding studies when they're feeding people more calories than they need to maintain their body weight. In these overfeeding studies, they show significant variability between individuals and how efficiently food is absorbed from the gastrointestinal tract, so small intestine primarily. This sort of efficiency relationship is known as the fractional energy absorption, or FEA. Healthy individuals on average absorb about 90 to 95% of the energy contained within food, the rest being lost in feces and urine, mostly feces, some in the urine. Controlled feeding studies, however, have shown that individuals' energy absorption can range from 80 to 95%. In these overfeeding studies, there seems to be an increase in the fraction of energy lost in the feces and urine. So you give people more calories, they seem to lose more of it. Less of it seems to be absorbed, although that is not standard across the board. Some people maintain the same amount of absorption and other people seem to lose more energy. Get less efficient. So if you were thinking like, maybe there's a difference between people who readily gain weight versus people who are resistant to gaining weight, this may be a source of some of that variation. I've linked the study, which is from 2020, in the description below.
That is a pretty interesting and I think underappreciated topic. And part of that variation in absorption is, as you said, in healthy individuals. If you have somebody who has some type of gastrointestinal like disease state that limits their ability to absorb calories, this is how a lot of these kind of malnourished states end up appearing in people who either have, pancreatic insufficiency, their pancreas isn't able to function enough to help them digest and then subsequently absorb the food they take, or if they have like various kinds of inflammatory bowel diseases, or if they've had parts of their intestine cut out for some reason. It's all kind of the same ultimate physiology here. And the reason this is worth pointing out is because, you know, when you mention energy balance and the energy intake or quote unquote calories in and energy expenditure, quote unquote calories out, and people will say, well, it's not as simple as the calories in and calories out. But this is actually a situation where the calories in is not necessarily being reflected by the calories that the person puts in their mouth when they eat, but rather the calories that are ultimately absorbed into the body and metabolized. That's kind of what determines the calories in. This concept of losing energy in the stool does not like violate that overall relationship of energy balance or of the energy intake and expenditure, because intake is not just what goes in the mouth, but actually what ends up also getting absorbed and metabolized and metabolized to energy stores and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, people are like, oh, it's not just as simple as calories in, calories out. I'm like, well, it is. But if you think that calories in versus calories out is simple, I implore you to dig further, because it's very complicated. Both of those, the sides of the equation, if you will, are dynamic. The other thing I'll say, you have people with these bowel diseases, like SPRU, celiac comes to mind, which is not technically an IBD, but when people have that autoimmune disease, one of the symptoms is that they lose weight. They lose weight because they're not absorbing the food that they're putting in their mouth. Principally that's just due to a reaction to gluten or other similar proteins that tend to be pro-inflammatory and messes with their gut. And so when they eliminate gluten from their diet, what happens? They gain weight. The idea of like going gluten-free to be like as like a weight loss promoting diet, like, nah.
Not the move.
Not the move, as somebody would say. So in any case, you basically have the food that goes in the mouth. That's one factor. And then the food that gets absorbed and metabolized. And so the metabolizable energy is the difference between the amount of energy you ingest that goes in the mouth and the amount of energy that's lost in the feces and urine. Usually per gram of food, it's 4 calories, the capital C for protein, 4 calories for every gram of carbohydrates, and 9 calories for every gram of fat. Also with respect to energy intake, food intake varies significantly between individuals and among individuals at a given meal, meaning that people are eating different sized meals at breakfast, lunch, dinner, or a snack, if they're following that typical pattern. That's not only like from day to day in a single individual, but also between individuals. However, there's less variability over a day in total amount of energy intake consumed. Usually it's because we compensate. So what that means, if you have a big breakfast, you're like, yo, we're going out, it's breakfast time. And you go to, I'm going to Denny's. That's me. I'm having a Moons over my hammy. I'm crushing that thing. Like, don't judge me. That's what I want. The subsequent meals, I'm going to eat less as a compensatory sort of response. This doesn't really happen, however, if a lot of the energy that you take in comes from sugar-sweetened beverages. So soda, for example, or alcohol. Both of those things, liquid calories in particular, tend to stimulate less of that compensatory response, meaning that you're going to eat, in this case, drink more calories, but you're not going to make up for it. You're not going to make up for it by eating less later in the day.
And just to be clear, because you didn't explicitly point it out, but when you said that you would compensate by eating less at subsequent meals, lots of people might assume that that means that because you are lean and jacked, that you are doing that, deliberately or intentionally, you're consciously choosing to do that. The point here is that when people are observed in these kind of settings, that compensation, that compensatory behavior, again, assuming that the extra calories are not coming from sodas and other sugar sweetened drinks, if it's coming from like food sources, then people tend to spontaneously eat less calories or energy over the course of the rest of the day, such that on a day-to-day basis, their overall calorie intake tends to, more or less kind of even out.
Yep. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Because effectively, the energy intake is a function of the balance between hunger and satiety in a given environment. So the sensations and behaviors associated with energy intake result from biological, psychological, social, and environmental inputs that, when integrated, influence hunger and feelings of fullness, which we call satiety. So effectively, if you're really, really hungry, you're experiencing that sensation, and you're in a food environment that is replete with very tasty snacks. These tend to be ultra processed, hyper palatable, which is a fancy way of saying very, very tasty, that are energy dense. They contain a lot of calories. Good luck. I'm not saying that you have no control, but less control than you think, because a lot of these behaviors are automatic. They happen, as Austin said in one of our previous YouTube videos, they happen at a subcortical level. You're not necessarily aware of what's going on, and you're making these automatic behaviors.
And arguably, the more automatic the behavior is going to be, the more conscious effort it would require to override that. And the amount of conscious kind of effort-based resources people have available to like continuously override those automatic behaviors, you'll run out pretty quick. Like if you were, again, completely surrounded, you're really into candy and you're in a candy store, as an example, it'll take a lot of conscious effort to go, one meal, two meals, three meals all day, sticking to, a quote unquote better diet that you're wanting to stick to and not have some of that candy as in that example. And so this idea of like automatic eating behaviors and the subcortical stuff, the deeper, not conscious, quote unquote, rational parts of our brains that are driving a lot of these behaviors, this will come back and be pretty important later.
Yeah. Yep. But if you're wondering overall, like what's the energy intake look like for people in the United States, an interesting finding is that it's technically gone down if you look at the data that we actually have. So the most recent data we have on this, this is based on 9 national surveys in the United States, about 64,000 adults. So from 1971 to 1975, it was about 1,955 calories per day. That was the average intake. From 2003 to 2004, it was 2,269 calories per day. So it went up a little bit in that interval. But then in 2009 to 2010, it went back down to 2,195 calories per day. Now there's some problems here with, you know, somebody in the our listening audience is like, well, how did they measure the intake? That's a great question. So they're using dietary recalls that in 2003 and 2004, in 2009 and 2010 were basically the same. They're a computer assisted dietary interview system. So people like click on foods they normally eat and then guess the size. They do typically under report by 10%, but the variance is not different in that time interval. What I mean is that both sets of data are under reporting by about the same amount. The interesting thing with under reporting though, this does not seem to be the same across individuals with different levels of body fat. So people who have what a quote unquote normal BMI, so, you know, between 18.5 and 25, tend to underreport their energy intake per day by about 10%. It's the number you'll find most often in literature, but individuals with BMIs greater than 30 tend to underreport their intake by 20 to 31% on average, which is a significant difference. And so you might be thinking, based on that, you're like, if these people just knew how much they were supposed to eat, if they just knew how much they were supposed to eat, we could solve this obesity epidemic. We could. We would just tell them how much they're supposed to eat, and then they would eat it, and then we'd be out of this. More on that to come, but hold that thought. Hold that thought. Also, if you were wondering on children, like what does their average calorie intake look like? Yeah, so from 1999 to 2010, it decreased on average from 2,258 calories to 2,100 calories in boys. A similar size decrease was also seen in women, but the girls in this case, but it was less absolute energy. I think it was from 1,800 down to 1,700 and change. So when people are like, energy intake is going up, we're eating more than ever. I don't know if that's the case. I don't know if our actual energy intake is going up compared to the early 2000s and mid 2000s. And that some of that may be due to, you know, like obesity levels are leveling off a little bit. And some of that may be due to reporting issues. But I don't know, Austin, what's your take on that? Do you think we're eating more now than ever? Or do you think it's about the same or what?
I guess my initial thought is I don't know how useful having like one average calorie intake estimate for the population is in general.
Oh, you know, 100%. Like, yeah.
It's like whatever this means, it's not especially informative as far as like what we should do with people either at a population level or on an individual level. Ultimately, you know, those individuals who are either at risk of developing obesity or who already have obesity, like we kind of know, and we are generating an increasing number of tools that we can use to help manage those conditions or mitigate the risk of progression and things like that. The factors in the social environment and food system and things like that that drive a lot of this, again, from this like kind of automatic eating behavior standpoint, given what surrounds us all the time, that's a much tougher nut to crack. And that's something I'm sure we'll come back to. But insofar as obesity rates are increasing, then for those who are developing obesity, they are, consuming more calories. But again, I don't know how much I care about like an average calorie intake for the whole population.
No. Yeah. I mean, it's giving you a snapshot. It's kind of like the sugar intake, for example, has actually gone down in the last few decades because people want to blame sugar for the obesity epidemic. And it's like,
there's been some, I guess, I mean, to the extent that that's a good thing, which I would not dispute that it probably is, I wouldn't blame all of obesity on it. I think that that's been the result of some effective kind of public messaging campaigns. I know that in like the pediatric world, even when both of us were like going through med school and in doing pediatrics rotations in clinic and stuff, everybody was like really hammering, like, you know, are you giving your kids a bunch of fruit juices and things like that and trying to really aggressively decrease that. And that was, you know, 10 years ago. So I think that we're hopefully seeing some of the effects of that.
Yeah. I mean, when you ask people what's the most commonly consumed fruit that they have? It's mostly fruit juice, you know, just like the most commonly consumed vegetables, potato chip. And you're like, dang it, we're missing it. But the sugar thing shouldn't, you know, be, entirely implausible because the most consumed foods are not like just raw sugar or like, you know, super sweet things. What they are a combination of a lot of dietary fat and sugar and salt together. And it's like, Yeah, because those are the tasty things.
Yeah, yeah, there aren't people sitting at home throwing down spoonfuls of sugar.
Do you remember, this is our first seminar ever. We're in San Antonio, and I had never seen this before in my life. Those Haribo, like, gummy worm things.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a dude there just crushing them, and I'm like, bro, that's like straight up sugar. Just like straight up.
Maybe if you had the sugar-free kind, although I've heard the reputation of those.
That's what I'm saying.
Those are famous for their Amazon reviews causing osmotic diarrhea.
Yeah, I was like, if these are the sugar-free ones, we're not going to see this dude on day two. He's going to be. Yeah. Anyway. All right. So that's energy intake in a nutshell. To recap, energy intake is all the foods that you take in over a set period of time. Usually it's in a given day. A lot of the behaviors that drive energy intake are automatic and relationship to biological, psychological, social, and environmental inputs that are integrated together. And when I say automatic, I just mean they're happening. They're less conscious than you would otherwise expect them to be. And so the idea that you're just going to overcome, you're going to use willpower, do this, all this other stuff is probably not a suitable long-term strategy for sustainable weight change. Okay. Energy expenditure. So this is typically referred to as total daily energy expenditure, or TDEE, the total amount of calories that are used, or in many cases referred to as burned per day. The three major components of total daily energy expenditure are: one, resting energy expenditure; two, diet-induced energy expenditure; and three, activity-induced energy expenditure. So we'll talk about all three. So resting energy expenditure, this is aka the resting metabolic rate. Resting metabolic rate is often confused with the basal metabolic rate. They are pretty similar measures. The difference is that the basal metabolic rate requires a full 12-hour fast beforehand, so it's a little bit more accurate and tends to be a little bit more precise, whereas measures of the resting metabolic rate tend to be about 10% higher than the basal metabolic rate and account for about 60 to 80% of total daily energy expenditure. So all that is a fancy way of saying that BMR and RMR are basically measuring the same thing. Just one requires a little bit extra step to get a very precise value. And in any case, the resting energy expenditure makes up, you know, close to 2/3 to 3/4 of your total daily energy expenditure. The main contributor here is your lean body mass. So if you're looking like, what's the number one contributor to my basal metabolic rate, to my resting metabolic rate, however you're going to measure it, it's your lean body mass. The more lean body mass you have, the higher your resting energy expenditure is. There is a large variability in energy expenditure from this resting energy expenditure, upwards of 200, 300 calories that are really not explained by the amount of lean body mass between individuals. This is probably genetics.
Just so everybody's on the same page who might be coming to the topic to begin, can you define lean body mass for them so they know, hey, if I want to increase my energy expenditure via increasing my resting metabolic rate, via increasing my lean body mass, what should I be doing? What is lean body mass?
Yeah, technically speaking, this is all mass of the body that's not fat. As far as the most modifiable component of that, it's going to be the skeletal muscle. Because you can gain muscle mass, but technically includes, you know, things like tendons, ligaments, visceral organs. If you really wanted to, like, I did think about this. So you think about the most expensive tissues that you have, like brain, kidneys, liver, whatever. So you're like, I could probably give myself like hepatomegaly, just like get a huge liver, and that's going to be super, super expensive. I'll lose some weight. Get a big old brain, you know, like lose some weight because my resting bottom metabolic rate goes up. But yeah, in the literature, you'll see, some people refer to this as fat-free mass, and other, researchers will call it lean body mass. But when we're talking about lean body mass as the main contributor, we're talking about muscle mass. So if you want your resting metabolic rate to go up, get more jacked, just like that. You just tell people gain muscle mass and they'll do it. But in any case, between individuals, there's a fairly substantial, variation in how much energy is expended. That's not really explained by how much lean body mass they're carrying. And we think this is due to genetics.
Some people just run hot.
Yeah. Now we should be clear. Yeah. From a metabolic standpoint. But you know, when people are like, oh, I have a low metabolism, that doesn't really seem to be the case with respect to predisposing folks to maintaining extra adipose tissue stores So like maintaining obesity, you could have a situation where people have a slightly slower metabolism, like on the order of a couple hundred calories, and they would gain weight faster. But as far as maintaining that, it does not appear to be, there does not appear to be a big like slow metabolism contribution to that. So just some interesting nuance there. It may predispose you to like getting to that point, but as far as maintaining extra adipose tissue, probably not. As far as what happens to your resting energy expenditure when your body weight changes. So changes in body weight produce changes in lean body mass levels, which in turn change the amount of energy you expend at rest. During periods of active weight loss, there's some evidence that some individuals' resting energy expenditure changes out of proportion to the change in lean body mass. So this would be like metabolic adaptation, if you will, or adaptive thermogenesis. But these changes are not only variable, but they tend to dissipate during periods of long-term weight maintenance. So even as short as like 4 to 6 weeks after a weight loss phase. However, in some individuals, this metabolic adaptation may defend against weight changes in the first place. So some people may like prefer, their bodies may prefer to be carrying extra body fat, this sort of maintenance of obesity, which is another problem. It's just a more complex thing than like, just try eating less and moving more. There are multiple ways in which redundant systems within the body can foil your plan here. So that's resting energy expenditure. The next item here is diet-induced energy expenditure. This is also referred to as TEF, or the thermic effect of food. This describes the energy required to digest, absorb, transport, and store energy from food. One way to think about the thermic effect of food is that it represents the energy expenditure increase from baseline within the first 3 to 4 hours of eating a meal. In this view, the thermic effect of food represents a 10 to 15% increase in energy expenditure after consuming a meal. This peaks about 2 hours before gradually returning to baseline. In most nutrition studies, we assume this, like the total amount of calories burned in a given day from diet-induced energy expenditure, to be about 10% of the total energy intake. So if you're eating 3,000 calories a day, we assume this is 300 calories worth of energy devoted towards the thermic effect of food. But there's substantial variation between individuals. And in the nutrition book, this is one of the sections that I like went to town on. And I'm like not looking at it again, because it just, when I read through it, I get sad for like how far down the rabbit hole I actually went. But there are studies showing the thermic effect of food changes as people age, when people exercise, how much lean body mass they're carrying, various genetic connections, etc. We assume it to be 10%, but it could be as little as, you know, 5 or 4% in some folks and closer to 20% in other folks. We just average it out to be 10.
And all of this impacts, again, that like kind of energy out or calories out or energy expenditure side of the equation that we don't directly measure on a person-to-person level. But this could be, again, just one of the many pieces of this energy balance sort of equation that could contribute to or explain the differences that two people might have in their experience in working through weight loss, where one person may have an easier time and another person may have a harder time. And the conclusion is not, this whole idea of energy balance and calories, you know, consumed versus expended is irrelevant, but rather that different components of this kind of equation, this balance setup are kind of more or less relevant for each of these two different people in two different ways.
Yep. Yeah. It's unsatisfying to be like, we don't really know, but I'm waiting for like this doubly labeled carbon study where you put people in a metabolic ward and you feed them food that's been labeled, you know, in a differential way. And it's like, so we can accurately measure your TEF under various conditions. Hasn't been done yet. In any case, so we had the resting energy expenditure, we have the diet-induced energy expenditure, now finally we have the activity-induced energy expenditure. And this refers to the calories used during exercise and non-exercise activity. The total amount of calories burned from exercise is termed the exercise activity thermogenesis, or EAT, and the total amount of calories used from non-exercise activity is called non-exercise activity thermogenesis, or NEAT. NEAT is further broken down or categorized into voluntary behavioral activities such as walking, climbing stairs, household chores, etc., and also involuntary activities such as fidgeting, twitches, frequent standing, and other unconscious movements. Those are called spontaneous physical actions, SPA, if you will. In any case, this is the most variable component of total energy expenditure. So activity-induced energy expenditure is the most variable component of total daily energy expenditure, is typically between 20 to 40% of total daily energy expenditure for most individuals. During weight loss, it should be noted that formal exercise does not appear to like burn less calories. So that's like a myth. People are like, well, I heard once I'm losing weight or when I'm losing weight, I'm going to burn less calories from exercise. That's not really the case. But the non-exercise activity thermogenesis does appear to change based on additional biological and environmental factors. And this is not universal across the board. Some people, when they lose weight, their NEAT actually increases. Some people, when they lose weight, their NEAT goes down when they try to lose weight. And it's like people are defending or preserving against weight loss. And some those people may have a more difficult time losing weight. It's just yet another input that may be sabotaging somebody's efforts to lose weight.
Yeah. And many of those kind of components of non-exercise activity, not necessarily all of them, but many of them are similarly not conscious, automatic, just like things that, you know, again, that subcortical, those subcortical areas of the brain can be like, nah, I'm not going to do this right now if we're given it. And so they'll burn that many fewer calories because they're not doing that given task. Whereas others, again, may have a different experience. They may be less susceptible to that weight loss induced decrease in NEAT. Theirs may go up. And so again, like so much of this is driven by underlying biology and kind of like the cards that you were dealt up front, most of which you did not choose.
You know what grinds my gears is when people talk about making conscious choices to increase their NEAT. They're like, hey, you know, because what they read is an abstract somewhere that's like NEAT, you know, changes in non-exercise activity thermogenesis may contribute to, you know, altered weight loss outcomes. You know, so the thought being like if your energy expenditure from NEAT goes down while you're trying to lose weight, it's, you know, sabotaging your efforts to lose weight. And so if you could only just increase NEAT back up to a normal level, you would be successful. And so these people are like, you got to jack up your NEAT, pump up your NEAT. And so what you should do to do that is walk more. And you're like, that's not NEAT.
Just exercise.
That's exercise. This is a conscious, like purpose-driven, locomotive. It's exercise, dude. Like, it's not NEAT. It's like it's like telling yourself, hey, self, what I want you to do is I want you to subconsciously fidget more so you burn more energy. It's like, bro, what? No, that's not something you have control over. Anyway, it just grinds my gears. People are like, increase your NEAT. I'm like, increase your intelligence. Why do you say that? Stop saying that. Okay, I'll get off my high horse. Let's summarize all the stuff we talked about today. Dr. B, what do you got for us?
Well, you did go through some kind of preliminary definitions of the calorie as a unit of measure of energy. And so we kept using the word energy frequently. So when we talk about energy intake, we're talking about the calories that an individual consumes in their diet. We talked about all the things that can regulate or influence the amount of energy, i.e. calories, that a person consumes in a given day. We talked a little bit about how people can compensate for overfeeding, how people don't compensate really well for sugar-sweetened kind of beverages a lot. And this will become more relevant again later on. We also talked about variation when it comes to energy intake and how much people actually absorb, which is not a massive fraction, but it's just a component of this overall kind of energy balance sort of equation. And it's worth pointing out and taking note of. So that was most of what we saw on the energy intake side. What do you think with respect to energy expenditure?
Yeah, energy expenditure, the three major components we covered. We talked about resting energy expenditure, diet related energy expenditure, and activity related energy expenditure. All of these things have significant variation between individuals. From the resting energy expenditure, the main contributor there is going to be lean body mass. So if you wanted to jack up your resting energy expenditure, you would get more jacked. The diet induced energy expenditure refers again to the cost of digesting, metabolizing, absorbing, and storing food. And there's substantial variation there amongst individuals. This may change as people are trying to lose weight, gain weight, et cetera, and it's not going to change uniformly. So again, some people may be more resistant to weight change than others. And for activity induced energy expenditure, there's two principal contributors. One is going to be exercise related. The other one's going to be non-exercise related. This is the most variable component of your day-to-day energy expenditure, how active you are. 20 to 40% of your total daily energy expenditure comes from activities. And to the extent that this changes as you change your weight, usually the energy expended During exercise doesn't change, but the energy expended from non-exercise activity does change, but again, not uniformly across individuals. So the big take home for me from this is that, yeah, there are three components that contribute to energy expenditure, but there is a large inter-individual variation in how people regulate all this stuff. And we can't just say, hey, you know, your metabolism is this, and it's going to change this way. If you gain weight, lose weight, try to, you know, what otherwise change your body composition, because there, again, are these substantial differences between folks.
That are, for the most part, not consciously chosen or determined for in the overwhelming majority of situations.
Yeah. Yep. Which, yeah, maybe unsatisfying for some, but I think it opens the doorway to different useful solutions that we'll talk about on part two of this podcast coming up next week. So for Dr. Baraki, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Thank you for listening. Again, if you could fill out the survey, it's linked in the description below. All of the studies that we talked about today are also linked in the description below, in addition to a link to our app. It's free in the Apple App Store. You can try out the first week of any of our templates for free on the app, and check out our merch. Help support Barbell Medicine. We'll catch you here next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. See ya.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.